Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you live here in Michigan, there's a very good chance that you'll head up north this summer, or maybe you'll head to the west side of the state to bask in the sun on the Lake Michigan shoreline. But if you're still not sure where to escape this summer, we've uncovered some hidden vacation gems you are sure to enjoy. And we're going to find out what's happening right now at the Mackinac Policy Conference. But first, it appears the 2014 race for Michigan governor is taking shape. Former Michigan Congressman Mark Schauer has filed papers to run as a Democrat. Other Democrats had tested the water. They explored their chances and stepped off in favor of Mark Schauer. His political career began with the Battle Creek City Commission, and then it was on to the state legislature and then to Congress, where he served one term representing the Battle Creek area before being unseated in a 2010 rematch with Tim Walberg. Mark Schauer is at the Mackinac Policy Conference, and he joins us now from Mackinac Island. Very good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Let's talk a little to begin with about ambivalence. When you talked earlier this year about whether or not you would enter the gubernatorial race, wasn't there a little sense of hesitance?
Oh, no. When I lost my job in Congress in 2010, it was a chance for my wife and I to make up for some lost time. I've said the two favorite words in the English language for me are Grandpa Schauer. I've got four little grandkids, and I can't possibly spend enough time with them. I've gotten really good at Star Wars Legos. But the work that I've been doing for the last couple of years is very rewarding. I have worked for a collaborative partnership between the Construction Laborers Union and our contractors, helping to put people to work. It's fantastic. But I have to admit, there's been a call to return to public service in this way as an elected official. And the draw is that I grew up in this great state. I was raised by a teacher and a nurse, and like many people growing up in the 60s and 70s, you felt that if you studied hard, got a good education, you could do anything you wanted to. But I see that really changing for people. The policies that Governor Snyder and a very extreme Republican majority in the legislature have pushed is putting that dream out of reach for so many. And my biggest concern is the cuts and the quote unquote reforms that have been being imposed on our schools and public education. I think the single most important investment we can make in creating an economy that works for everyone is investing in education. And here at this conference, we heard from Jeb Bush, Michelle Rhee will talk about some of these quote-unquote reforms that are more, that really mirror what Governor Snyder has been doing, and that's sort of voucherizing and profitizing education rather than really supporting teachers and supporting our schools. And I will add, too many schools and school districts are in financial crisis right now.
And we've certainly heard from them. We hear from cities saying that they're hurting. So clearly you saw and heard things that impelled you to consider running. And then you talked with a lot of people in your party before you decided to run, asking, can I win? I'm wondering, what did you hear that convinced you that the answer was yes?
Well, so many individuals and groups of people, whether they were teachers or women who want access to very, basic health care, group after group felt either attacked or aggrieved by this governor and the Republican Party that controls every lever of government right now in Michigan. I mean, I think, Michigan is a moderate state, and all the people encountered me on the sidewalk, or old high school classmates found me on Facebook, or again, some leaders that I'd worked with in government, contacted me and said, Mark, please do this. Our state is going in the wrong direction. We need a change in Lansing. And so it was really a strong, just a groundswell of support and flattering on the one hand, but more important than that, gave me a sense that we can do this. And I've run many tough campaigns in my day. I've unseated Republican incumbents twice in tough districts, and what I want everyone to interpret from my decision to run for governor is not only can we win, but we will win.
Some political observers are saying now that you are in the race that there likely will not be a Democratic primary. Is that a good thing for Michigan voters in your view?
I think it's good for our ability to change the direction in Michigan. I mean, the fact that Gary Peters has emerged as our consensus candidate for U.S. Senate is to replace the irreplaceable Carl Levin is a great sign, and I couldn't be more excited and more supportive of Gary. And the fact that folks have coalesced around me, I think, is a good sign. And what it represents is that, you know, Democrats, who I think really do represent the mainstream of people in Michigan, are unified. I talked about all the folks who have been aggrieved or attacked by Governor Snyder's policies. They're motivated. They're united. Will Rogers used to say, "I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat." Well, that's not true in Michigan. And we're focused. This is not about politics. This is about our state. This is about an economy that works for everyone, not just for a few at the top or the special interests. And so that's what inspires me, and I see a really a cohesive group of folks that have given me confidence to do this.
Well, Mark Schauer, as you look ahead to this impending gubernatorial race, and even though we're talking, you know, a year and a half out, but what do you see have coalesced as the main issues in this race? You talked about the school spending. What else is on your plate?
Well, what Governor Snyder has done is, in his first year in office, I think he laid out his economic philosophy, and it's really the same old tried and tired and failed supply-side economics. It's, you know, Ronald Reagan tried it, created huge budget deficits. Both Bushes tried it, and that was, you know, give big tax cuts to corporations, and it will, you know, trickle down to everybody else. Well, that's what he did, and he did that. He paid for it by taking $1 billion away from our schools and then creating a new pension tax on retirees, took away child tax credit, took away other credits for things like supporting public radio or food banks, community foundations, things that really matter to a community, raise property taxes, cut back severely a tax credit for low-wage earners. That takes money out of people's pockets that actually help grow the economy. So I think we need to, you know, education should be our number one priority, and then supporting manufacturing, supporting the auto industry, just like I did when I was in Congress.
You know, you were among the thousands of protesters who demonstrated last December at the Capitol when Right to Work was passed in the lame duck session. In fact, you were actually pepper sprayed during the demonstration. That time in Lansing seemed so politically heated and so charged and so controversial. Do you think you can change that dynamic as governor? Yeah,
I think I can. I've always represented districts that have been very split, evenly split, even sort of tilted Republican. And, you know, folks that know me know that I like to bring people together to solve problems. And that's a difference. I think the Right to Work issue and Governor Snyder's flip on that issue was shown that, you know, he's really just another politician. And he said it would be divisive for our state, wasn't on his agenda. He was right. It is divisive for our state. And I think, you know, when we look at, again, the resurgence of the auto industry, there were historic collective bargaining agreement between the UAW and the auto companies that's, you know, I just bought a brand new Ford C-Max hybrid made at the Michigan Assembly Plant in Wayne, Michigan. That's a product of that partnership. And so not only has that been damaged by the actions of this governor, but, you know, the data shows that it puts Michigan on a path of lower wage, lower skilled jobs. And my vision for Michigan is that we are a high wage, high skill state and a global leader.
you know, running for governor, I don't need to tell you, will obviously take a lot of money, Mark Schauer. And as the incumbent, Governor Snyder has that established campaign and fundraising system in place. How challenged do you feel by that?
Well, you know, I know I will never be able to match a millionaire dollar for dollar when he put $6 or $7 million of his own money into his campaign last time. I mean, I think the governor has shown that, and Right to Work is an example of this. His tax policy is an example. You know, he's relying on other millionaires and billionaires to help him. I mean, right out of the gate at this Mackinac policy conference, he had Doug DeVos and Jeb Bush raise money for him. Donald Trump was just in Oakland County stumping for him. So those are people that will fund his campaign. And I'll tell you, from the response from my announcement this week through Facebook and social media, it's just off the charts. And we're gonna win by having the numbers. We're gonna win by having the grassroots supporters, folks who know me, that have confidence in me, know that I'm a very disciplined candidate, and that means that I do what it takes to have the resources to run a winning campaign and get out our message.
Mark Schauer, we want to thank you very much for speaking with us today. I know this isn't the last time we'll be talking.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
It is day two on Mackinac Island at the Detroit Regional Chamber's big annual policy conference. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now from the island. Rick, education certainly seemed to be front and center at the conference today. Fill us in.
Yeah, actually, a lot of the sessions seem to be focused on education reform, and particularly what's going on in the Detroit schools, although there are certainly implications statewide. That we had Michelle Rhee. She's the leader of Students First. She's the CEO, and she's kind of controversial in the education reform movement. She came and talked to this group and basically advocated for merit pay, for more student choice, for things like that. The governor announced that the foundation that will pay for the educational authority that will run the state's most persistently low-performing schools is $60 million towards a $100 million goal. And the idea is that it will be entirely privately funded. And so, you know, we're hearing a lot of talk about that. And all of this is happening under the backdrop of an education budget that was just sent to Governor Snyder that basically stalled enactment of the Common Core standards. They're sort of national standards that are supposed to make sure that every state and every school are measuring student performance in the same fashion. And the Educational Achievement Authority, which is right now operating in Detroit,
right,
legislation that would move that statewide is still stalled in the Senate. So there's a lot of push here to the legislature. The governor has backing from his friends in business saying, get that stuff done.
And Michelle Rhee is very much in favor of the Common Core standards.
Yes, very much so. As a matter of fact, the legislature has taken a couple of grenades from the people who spoke here. Jeb Bush yesterday made a pretty passionate plea for Michigan to not back out of adopting those standards, and Michelle Rhee basically backed that up today.
Meantime, politicking is in full force because that's just what happens at Mackinac, isn't it?
Oh, there is plenty of politicking up here. You know, it's really the Democrats are the most prominent at this moment. That yesterday, Jeb Bush, who was a Republican governor, like Rick Snyder, as a matter of fact, they're sometimes compared. He gave a pretty full-throated endorsement of Rick Snyder yesterday. But really, the field has been left to Mark Schauer, who it looks like is going to be the governor's Democratic adversary in November of 2014, that Gary Peters, the so far uncontested Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate seat that's being vacated by Carl Levin, that he's been pretty prominent here, both of them roaming the porch and the halls, glad-handing, raising money, and
accepting any and all contributions, right?
Well, as a matter of fact, Mark Schauer filed his for his campaign committee on Tuesday because it is illegal for a candidate to accept a campaign check without a campaign committee to take the check.
And finally, Rick, what's on tap for tomorrow, which is really the last full day, isn't it?
I said that the candidates for the Senate and governor here, and also we've got Detroit mayoral candidates. People are talking about a new Detroit Free Press poll that shows it to be a dead heat between Mike Duggan and Benny Napoleon, although there's still plenty of room for a candidate to move ahead, and so we're hearing from them. Tomorrow, we will hear from the legislative leaders about what's going on in Lansing, and, you know, based on what we just talked about a few minutes ago, Cindy, one might expect they got some splaining to do. And we're actually, as soon as this conference wraps up tomorrow, we're going into another conference. The governors of the Great Lakes states are on their way to Mackinac Island for a two-day conference tomorrow and Saturday that will deal with issues like invasive species and maybe some regional economic questions.
Also, we'll get updated on that next week. Well, thank you so much, Rick, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Good talking to you from Mackinac.
My pleasure.
All right. From politics and business to pleasure. And if you haven't decided where to take your vacation this summer in Michigan, we've got you covered. We all know about the big hits: Mackinac Island, Leelanau, the Lake Michigan shoreline, the Thumb, the Traverse City area. How about some of the lesser known vacation spots that you might have overlooked? For that, we turn now to Jim Dufresne. He's the editorial director of MichiganTrailMaps.com. And he's the author of more than 20 outdoor hiking and camping books, including Lonely Planet travel guides. And he joins us here in the studio. It's very good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
So MichiganTrailMaps.com, tell us a little about what you do.
Well, MichiganTrailMaps.com is about a two-year-old website. It's a resource website. And what we do is we go out and we map trails with GPS units, and we use topos and satellite imagery, produce these great trail maps, post them online with trail descriptions and the kind of information you need. People can go on there, search by trails, by county or activity. The great thing is you read about a trail, you can download that map, print it out, put it in your back pocket, go hiking or mountain biking or skiing or whatever you're thinking of doing that trail. It's kind of we really like to promote trail usage.
And Michigan is just very, very rich with great trails, aren't we?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons is because we have three national parks. We have one of the best state park systems. We have a huge acreage of public land. We have four national forests. We have like six state forest areas. All that public land lends itself to great trails. We also had a lot of railroads, so that's the reason for the growing number of rail trails that are also taking place.
Did I hear, tell me if I'm wrong, but I thought I heard this week somewhere that Michigan leads the nation in the rail into trail.
Well, I've always thought it was second and third. And
still way up there.
You're still way up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing we have that a lot of people don't realize is that the North Country Trail, which is a national trail that someday will be like 4,500 miles long from North Dakota to New York, we have the biggest chunk, 1,100 miles, because it goes right across the UP, crosses the Mackinac Bridge, goes right through the middle of the Lower Peninsula, and then heads out in Ohio and so forth as it heads east. We were just really blessed with a wonderful trail system in Michigan.
And Jim Dufresne, you have traveled all over the world. What was it that brought you back to Michigan and really roots you here and has you so enthusiastic?
Well, I was born and raised in Michigan. I grew up in Michigan. I'm a Michigan State grad and so forth. But I had lived in other places, particularly Alaska. And the two things I soon discovered early in my life was that, one, I love coastline. Well, believe it or not, Alaska has the most. Michigan's number two. Mm. The other thing I really like is outdoor areas, wilderness areas, and while Alaska is a phenomenal place, Michigan's just, we just have a gem of a state. The only thing we don't have here that I kind of miss is mountains, but you know, I can live with sand dunes, so that's
can't
great.
Have everything, right?
Yeah, right, exactly.
I'm talking with Jim Dufresne, who's the editorial director of MichiganTrailMaps.com, and we're going to get into some hidden vacation gems. And we've asked Jim about to bring us his top five Michigan hidden vacation gems. So where do you want to start?
Let's start with the number one, and that's the Manitou Islands. And Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, a phenomenal place.
Yes.
Gets a lot of recognition.
It does.
Ever since it got in Good Morning America, it's the most beautiful place in the country. And then I was a little, well, it's beautiful. I wasn't sure about that, but, you know, that's okay. And if you go up there during the summer, it can be kind of crowded at times.
Yes.
The Manitou Islands, as a lot of people don't realize, it's part of the National Lakeshore. You jump on a ferry in Leland. You head out to either the south or north Manitou. Mm. They're great places to escape to. Now, a lot of people go out there and camp for a couple days, but South Manitou Island itself lends itself really well just to do a day visit. The ferry would arrive at 11 and comes back around 4:30 to take it back to Leland, and that gives you 4.5 hours. And what is there out there?
Right.
There's a wonderful lighthouse that they've renovated. There's great beaches. There's a shipwreck out there that's only about 30 yards offshore. The bow of the boat's only like 5 or 6 feet below the surface. It's the most popular snorkeling site in Michigan. There's a second shipwreck that's about 400 yards offshore. A third of it's above the water. It was a freighter that crashed in the 1960s. And people will hike out to check that out. And the largest white cedars in Michigan, there's a small grove of them on the backside of the island. You throw in these great beaches and these perched dunes. Magnificent place.
Now, let's just talk logistics. When you talk about the ferry coming over, does that bring you and your car or just you and your feet?
Well, the great thing about these two islands is there's no cars out there. There's also no stores. There's no place to stay except for campgrounds. So it's kind of a true escape. And so, you know, you take the ferry out. You want to make sure you catch the ferry back in if you're only spending a day. And that, lots of times during the summer, people will miss that ferry. So the park rangers out there have tents and sleeping bags, and campers will donate food into a box in case you need emergency food. But no, there's nothing developed. So it's a really wonderful escape.
Now, you list the Garden Peninsula as your second choice, and I have never heard of the Garden Peninsula.
Well, it's in the UP.
Mm-hmm.
And the UP itself is, I've always been stunned at the number of people, lifelong Michigan people, who have never gone across the Mackinac Bridge and never been in the Upper Peninsula, much less explore it.
You know, and you're talking to one. I guess I have pictures of myself at Taquamenon Falls when I was one or two.
Yes.
We keep saying, we have to really do the UP because it is another look at Michigan.
It's a great area. And well, the fact that there's only one interstate highway and it only goes 40 miles between the bridge and Sault Ste. Marie, you got to love that.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
But the Garden Peninsula is to the west along US 2, and it sticks down into Lake Michigan. It has some really neat areas. It has two vineyards, too, which is pretty unusual. A lot of people don't realize that there's a handful of vineyards in the Upper Peninsula.
Okay.
One of them kind of specializes in strawberry and blueberry wines, and you know, but another one grows grapes. It also has Fayette State Park. And what Fayette was, in the 1880s, it was a company town. Hmm. And they were mining iron ore from, I believe they were shipping it out of Wisconsin or Minnesota. And they were taking it down to Cleveland. But to reduce the weight, they'd stop at Fayette, they'd melt it down into pig iron, and then they ship it at a reduced cost. So this Jackson Iron Company built this entire town there, including an opera house, and all these buildings. And all of a sudden, after like 40, 50 years, they got up and they left. The town's still there. And it's the best ghost town in Michigan. It gives you a really nice slice of history, our mining history. And when you add that with the peninsula's great beaches and a lot of campgrounds there, it's a wonderful place.
So that's the Garden Peninsula. All right, Grand Island.
Love Grand Island. I like Pitchard Rocks, too. And Pitchard Rocks are really well known. It's another one of our three national parks. Pitchard Rocks is known for lighthouses and these 200-foot sandstone cliffs, redstone, colorful cliffs, and it's a place where backpackers, campers, and hikers would go.
Mm.
Again, it's really well known. It has boat tours and so forth, but really nearby is Grand Island, and it's much less crowded.
Okay.
You jump on a ferry from Unicene. It's only about a half mile. You can get over there. You can take mountain bikes on its trail system. You can hike them. There's walk-in campgrounds there. There's also sandstone cliffs and sea caves and formations. There's a lighthouse, and it's a great kayaking destination as well.
So it's not a very long ferry ride.
Half mile, you can see where you're going.
Yeah, some people are not enamored, going too long on that ferry, especially at the end of a long day, and you don't want to have to take a long time getting back.
Absolutely.
Let's move to Michigan's Thumb, which I adore Michigan's Thumb. We have relatives and friends with the cottages right there, Port Austin, and it is a great spot.
It's a great spot, and it's really laid back, especially when you compare it to the Gold Coast, the Lake Michigan shoreline.
Yes.
It's not overdeveloped. In fact, they're still struggling to return to, you know, get beyond this economic recession that we had. But it's a wonderful area. The best part about it it's 2 hours, 2.5 hours mm-hmm. from the Detroit area.
It is.
You know, you're not driving all day to get to Traverse City, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Port Austin is just it's a very historical town. Has some great restaurants and B&Bs. Mm-hmm. I love the Garfield House.
Been there, yes.
Been there. My two favorite restaurants up there is the Bank, 1884. The other one I really like is the Farm, and that's a little further away. It's southwest of Port Austin. It's like a 15-20 minute drive, and it's run by a couple who teaches at a culinary school at one of the local community colleges. And during the summer, they run this restaurant called the Farm, and the food is amazing. Two areas that are really cool up there to visit when between staying at the Garfield House and eating, Port Crescent State Park is at the very tip. Wonderful. Has sand dunes, which a lot of people are shocked. I also like Sanilac Historic Site. And what Sanilac is it's just in the middle of the thumb. Someone has to tell you about it for you to stop. There's not a lot of signs. But what happened was the farmer was burning off some brush, and he discovered petroglyphs. Mm. And it's the only really decent set we have in Michigan. And they've been protected now. And there's a trail system that goes around the whole area, and you can see other remains of the Native Americans. And it's not, you know, something you just drive there for, but just another neat little stop in the thumb area.
And I have to throw up a plug in just for personal experience. Again, as I say, we have friends with cottages in Port Austin and in Caseville. And I got to say, August brings cheeseburger in Caseville Festival.
Yeah.
It's a blast.
It's great.
Just a lot of fun. And Caseville's a great little town as well.
Yeah.
So.
Well, the other thing about which wild people don't realize about the thumb is you go to Port Austin, you can see a sunset.
Yes,
on Bird Creek County Park, there's a long pier. It's right downtown, and people gather there. It's like Key West. They clap afterwards. It's a really cool area.
And also, just to if you're planning for 4th of July, and we've done this, there is nothing like sitting out on the beach and watching the fireworks all the way. You can see all the way up past East Tawas.
Yes.
And there's these fireworks. It is spectacularly beautiful. And only in Michigan would you get that curve of the thumb and all the way out. All right, now we're going to move over to Emmett and Charlevoix counties. What do you like there, Jim?
Well, working on the website, we were doing a lot of these small trails up there. And the thing we noticed is it's a pretty rugged counties up there.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of high points. And most people go up there for Petoskey and Charlevoix. There's great shopping. Petoskey State Park has a wonderful beach with Petoskey Stones. That's what it's really known for.
Mm-hmm.
And Gaslight District is wonderful. But if you move inland a little bit, there's some wonderful high points. The best is the Avalanche Peak. And this is near Boyne City. And it used to be a downhill ski area. And it went out of business. And the whole area was given to the Boyne City. And they made it in a park. It's about 450 steps up. Yeah, it's a little bit of a climb. But you get to the top, it's the best view in the Lower Peninsula. Because you're right above Lake Charlevoix. You can look right down Lake Charlevoix. The two ridges that enclose it. And you can see Charlevoix and then Lake Michigan. Unbelievable view. And it's just a high point. Another one we like is Skyline Trail, which is, again, it's just southwest of Petoskey. It's actually along the North Country Trail, but it's a little spur, and it just takes you a great little high point with a view of a valley. And they built an observation deck there. It was so nice. The other thing you can do in these two, again, you got to get inland a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Go to Boyne Mountain or Boyne Highlands during the summer. And you can hike up their tall hills and then take the zip line back down. Each one has zip lines now.
Oh, so fun.
Yes.
That's fun.
Absolutely. And you're high up. You can get great views, and you have this exciting zip line down. And again, all you got to do is get away from the coastline in these two great counties, and you can have some fun.
And actually, you're tossing out ideas that even if someone's got a cottage, inevitably people are going to come visit. You're going to look for things to do or places to take them, and you've just offered up all kinds of great ideas. And the website that Jim is involved with is michigantrailmaps.com. He's the editorial director. Jim Dufresne, great tips for summertime, and we'll have to get you back, and we'll dig in for some fall things as well.
And then winter.
And then winter. Can't overlook winter.
Can't overlook
winter. We just don't want to think about it right now. Jim, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And it's Thursday, so it's time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. He's up at the Mackinac Policy Conference today. Daniel, it seems you're getting some interesting insights into how the financial and investing world views the Detroit auto companies. What are you hearing from the analysts and business leaders who've come to Mackinac?
Well, I think there's a sense that despite the performance the last few years and the really strong profitability of the Detroit Three, that Wall Street really still doesn't give it a whole lot of respect. And I think if you had to boil that down to one single why, it would probably be that they're not convinced that our people have learned the lessons of the crash. And will they be able to manage prosperity? I mean, one of the things I reported in today's column was there's a guy from Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, who argues that we could get to an annual selling rate of 18 million units, cars and trucks, by 2018, which would be, and maybe with an upside to 20 million, which, as you know, Cynthia, that is a record-breaking numbers.
Yeah.
And that would mean much huger profitability for our companies here. So the question is, can they manage prosperity? We've seen them manage through some very difficult times. They've had to change leadership and everything else, and now they're on the other side. They've got a much better business model. But how and whether they'll be able to manage prosperity, I think, is the big question to investors. And it's a question that the only way they're going to be answered is by their performance.
And it's really based on past performance as far as the cyclical nature, the ups and the downs. And in the past, there was a sense of it was still business as usual and they didn't learn hard lessons. But now, when you think about it, especially at General Motors and Ford, you don't have the old school auto guys running the show. You have folks from the outside. And I wonder if that is seen as something that is a positive.
I think it is seen as a positive, particularly at Ford and even at General Motors. Mm-hmm. But I think the difference is that in both of those cases, I think the smart money is on both of those gentlemen are going to be replaced by career people from within their car companies. The guy who's likely to replace Alan Mulally, Mark Fields, has been at Ford pretty much since he left the Harvard Business School 25 years ago. A couple of the favorites to replace Dan Akerson at General Motors are all GM people and have been for a very long time, which is fine. I mean, and they're different than some of the people their predecessors. But it's really an open question. And the companies, I think, are a little frustrated that they're not getting as much credit for some of the product and the quality product that they have out there. But it's just going to be a continuing challenge, and they can't walk away from that.
And what are you hearing and what do you think Michigan and the auto companies need to do to build that new narrative to appeal to those investment communities, because they're the folks that hold the purse strings of America?
Yeah. Number one is perform. Number two is to continue to make the case that they are different, and you show that by what you do, by how the products develop, by the results that you deliver every quarter, by the fact that you don't have a lot of excuses, or if you have problems, you cop to the problems at the jump, like Sergio Marchionne did last quarter, yeah. And say, we've got problems, and we know it, we're going to forget it, put it behind us. It's like to borrow a Red Wings analogy, it's like Jimmy Howard letting one through and saying, you know, I'm going to get the next one. You can't sit there and cry in the cage. It doesn't help anybody. So what they need to do is just continue to perform.
Now, that Red Wings thing makes me sad, so go easy on the Red Wings stuff. Such a sad ending.
we walked into a bar to catch it, and we were there for 2 minutes, and this shot goes in. Everybody turned around and walked out.
And it was like, we don't want...
Not going to watch anybody talk. We just walked out.
We don't want to see the handshake on the ice. We are done. You know, one other thing I noticed in your column today, Daniel Howes, is the gentleman you spoke with from the Bank of America Merrill Lynch, whose name was John Murphy, and I love that quote. Mm-hmm. He said that the investment community still looks at this as, quote, the crappy auto industry. But he doesn't believe that. So there are converts among those ranks in the investment community.
Yeah, and I've known John off and on for probably 15 years. He's been on Wall Street and is respected for what he does. And I think, and there are some guys out there, both on the equity side and on the credit side, who do believe in this narrative that John's putting forth, that these companies are fundamentally re-engineered. They have a much better operating structure. Labor is not the competitive disadvantage that it has been in the past, and that they think that we got a lot of upside here, which is particularly important given some of the problems you've got in other parts of the world, you know, Europe being one of the obvious ones we've talked about in the past.
Yeah. We're speaking with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes, our weekly Thursday check-in. And since we last talked, came word that Kevin Orr is looking at the Detroit Institute of Arts and its priceless collection as something that could possibly be used. Give me your thoughts on all of this.
Well, I would amend that statement just a little. I think what Kevin Orr is saying, and other people surrounded with this from the state, from the governor on down, is that they're stating a fact. That mm-hmm. is that the DIA's assets are owned by the city of Detroit. And as such, they could be vulnerable in a bankruptcy proceeding. And that's just a fact. And that may get people all bent out of shape, and I can understand why it does. But I've done a lot of reporting up here on the island and talking to a lot of people, and I think the people at the DIA, the leadership, they understand that too.
Mm-hmm.
They're also being beaten about the head and shoulders with woulda, coulda, shoulda. Why didn't you take actions earlier? Why didn't you move to protect the collection? Why didn't you create an authority? Could you have created a foundation? As you talk to them and this unspools a little bit, you start to get a picture that, and if we think back to what happened with the whole Belle Isle flap, you know, the whole notion of trying to move a collection that is valued in the billions into an authority, let's say, that mm-hmm. was controlled by a board, maybe coming from Wayne, Oakland, Macomb, Detroit, would have been politically explosive and, frankly, untenable. And I think they made the decision that they couldn't go forward. They couldn't go forward with this in the Kilpatrick years. They couldn't go forward with it in 2010 when they were doing the millage and getting that approved.
Right.
And so now here we are in 2013, and this is potentially at play. I don't think anybody involved in this process, based on my reporting, wants to see this happen. Not the governor, not the emergency manager, not the treasurer, certainly not the influential donors or the board of the DIA. The question is, can they get through on the other side?
To the stakeholders.
Right. But as a bankruptcy lawyer that I talk to a lot said to me, and I've heard from other people, they don't care. Creditors do not care where the money comes from. They just care if it's green. And they tend to make a very cold and heartless argument if it gets to that point in bankruptcy court to say, look, you are trying to get us to sacrifice a certain percentage on our total investment, and you're sitting on assets that you are not willing to liquidate. And so the question is, are they going to be able to get this through or get enough creditors to agree to a deal, potentially without touching the DIA? And I think nobody really knows the answer to that. And there's a lot of emotion attached to this, and a lot of people in Southeast Michigan and elsewhere, certainly in the museum world, realizing how important the museum is to them, to their lives, to the potential rebuilding of the city of Detroit. I mean, how do you rebuild a city on one hand and then and beggar it its cultural institutions on the other?
Right.
I think that's a very difficult, if not impossible. Anybody who knows a whit about these things knows that that's a legitimate way to look at things. Now, the other thing that's developing too, Cynthia, I should add, is you're starting to hear some weird alliances here. For example, unions are starting to talk about, well, what's more important, putting bread on the table of retirees and keeping their pensions whole, or saving pieces of art that nobody sees. And that's going to be an argument that's probably going to be made with a little more pitched intensity as we get into the summer.
We will be watching this, and I know we'll be having many more conversations on this topic as this story unfolds as it is. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes talking to us from Mackinac, where he's at the policy conference. Don't eat too much fudge.
I don't ever eat it, my dear.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
There is a real Detroit feel to the current season of the AMC series Mad Men. Now, over past seasons on Mad Men, Don Draper and his team at Sterling Cooper Draper Price have been involved in ad campaigns for everything from Lucky Strike to Hilton Hotels, Dow Chemical to Heinz Mustard and Maidenform, and last season, Jaguar, or Jaguar, as you will. This season, Don and Roger and crew have snagged GM and Chevrolet. And you can bet GM execs are watching closely, even though the automaker had absolutely no part in developing this storyline. But we wondered, will GM and Chevy possibly get a lift from these episodes? Joining us now is Michael Bernacki, who's the marketing professor at the University of Detroit Mercy. Hi, Mike. Good to have you back.
Good afternoon. Nice to be back.
So Jaguar was a very, very big part of last season with, I read, a 96.27% lift in content consumption. What does content consumption mean? And was that something that had them smiling at Jaguar?
Well, there's no doubt about it. You know, there's a difference between sales talk and sales verbiage and advertising. And when we talk about the notion of content here. We're meaning, you know, the buzz that surrounds the particular vehicle and how, of course, that increase. And it's really a remarkable push. I mean, you get those kinds of pushes for things like Super Bowl advertising this year. There was a lot of buzz regarding what happened during that time period. And so we find it, you know, from time to time. But to get it when you don't plant it, when it's not part of what you do, is extraordinary. And so the, if you will, the name, the brand name Jaguar, you know, attached to conversation is just remarkable. And they have nothing but smiles, or should have nothing but smiles, or had smiles on their face.
Even though Jaguar did not have the best image in that show. Anyone, if you watched last season, you know that one character tried to kill himself in a Jaguar, but he couldn't because the car wouldn't start.
It certainly pointed out the failing, you know, of the vehicle at that time. I mean, there's always a lot of problems, and the fact that Mad Men would not exactly paint any particular brand in a great light, I mean, is to be expected. But, you know, when you're discussing this, when it becomes part of your reality, you either have to turn your back and on it and say, you know, this is enough and this isn't us, and be haughty and be stiff and stodgy about it, or you have to find a way to embrace it and to use it. Jaguar decided they were not going to advantage themselves with this wonderful increased buzz.
They did not advantage themselves.
And, you know, they could have. I mean, you can take a look at a bad situation and talk about the changes. You can use humor with it, which is always a good way to diffuse problems. You know, you can build your present story. I mean, there's a lot of ways to be effective with it. But to just kind of kick it, you know, under the rug, just kick that can out of the way and forget about it as though it was something that was life-threatening, please. I would humbly say this was a missed opportunity, and they certainly did miss it.
I have to, and we, you know, it's worth reminding everyone, if you don't watch Mad Men, it's noted for its authentic delivery of what was going on in the 60s. And in this instance, it's 1968. Don Draper and his team are designing an ad campaign, as it turns out, not for the Camaro, not for the Corvette, but for the Vega, which is on a lot of lists as probably the worst car of all time, which, of course, Don and the gang have no way of knowing. You got to think, Mike Bernanke, you got folks at the Rensen saying, really, must we?
Well, I am sure that there is a lot of discussion regarding what is going to happen here and how it's going to happen. And as they're trying to strategize and decide, you know, what's going to go on here, they can certainly use the Jaguar experience to their benefit and see what happened there. Missed opportunity. And, you know, there is no doubt about it. Let's face it, that poor vehicle, which was a Chevy problem for quite some time, is long gone, and it's out of the way, and it's time to do something else. And the Vega, we all know, the Vega is one of the worst cars to ever come out of the U.S., much less out of GM's stock, if you will. Having said that, there are a lot of ways that this can be handled. And while nobody's called me from Chevy, from GM, and asked for advice, they can spin this to their advantage. And that's by rolling with a punch, by coming up with storylines that, you know, attach to that day and age. Because really, you know, that situation of two small agencies combining to land a big fish is not much different today. It's more difficult to do, but it's still in vogue. And so the storyline of 1968 has some application today as General Motors goes forward. So they just have to develop a plan, a strategy to advantage themselves of this buzz. And boy, it is going to grow. There is no doubt about it.
And it's interesting. You touched on the merging of the two small agencies. That's exactly, if you watch the show, that's what Don had to do, is merge with the rival firm that Peggy works for to get that Chevy account. And then turns out that's what happened in the 60s. There was a joint venture called Commonwealth that came together to take on the big guys like Campbell Ewald.
Yeah, and of course, as it turned out, of course, as you know, Campbell Ewald was spun out, you know, as a result. So what goes around on this kind of storyline you know, comes around, and it's the way it is. And the reason, of course, that happens is because everybody loves the creativity, the free and easiness of these small agencies as they have wonderful ideas. Not many of them really wind up with clients, but eventually, of course, some of them succeed. And the idea is to be ready for this success. As a matter of fact, you know, they can even use the fact that, yes, Campbell Ewald was let go as this most recent go-around, spin-around, but what the advantages have been as a result. So they can play this, if you will, both sides, from the success of General Motors past, and by the way, they're in one of their most successful spins right now. My gosh, could they want it to be any better? Should they be threatened by the Vega? Please. By 1968? Come on! Not at all.
Well, Matthew Weiner certainly sticking with that realism of what happened in 1968, and we'll all be watching as Mad Men unfolds with the Chevy Vega as a co-star.
It's an extraordinary story. And what I have to say to GM is, come on, folks, get in there, work this to your advantage, keep smiling, be grateful of the buzz, and maybe encourage it the best that you can, and you can be a victor, not a loser in this.
Michael Bernacki, marketing professor at the University of Detroit Mercy. Thanks so much, Michael.
Thanks for having me. Look forward for our next spin around the dance floor.
Well, we began today's program by talking with well-known Democrat Mark Schauer, who has filed papers saying he will run for governor in 2014. Well, there's a lesser-known candidate, an Ann Arbor man, says he too plans to run for governor. Michigan Radio's Rena Miller reports.
Robin Sanders is a Michigan corrections officer who served in Vietnam and in Desert Storm. Sanders says Michigan could shore up its budget by keeping business in the state.
I've seen the tendency of government to outsource in the form of third-party contracts that actually sends billions of dollars out of our state to other states and other countries, for that matter.
Sanders says he'd like to see state government workers return to a pension system. He supports statewide expansion of fracking for natural gas. Sanders does not support same-sex marriage. He says he'll make his candidacy official in August and run as an independent progressive. I'm Rena Miller, Michigan Radio News.